It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A pair of Wisconsin underwater archaeologists and maritime historians locate the wreckage of a lost ship from over a century ago near Algoma's Lake Michigan shoreline. We explore the schooner Trinidad and what you wonder about. Call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bob Jake is a board member of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association and a Great Lakes shipwreck hunter. Bob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me on your morning show.
Good morning. So it takes 2 years for you to find the remains of the Trinidad, which sank in Lake Michigan in 1881. How did the historical documents you dug up lead you and fellow shipwreck hunter Brendan Baylod to the Trinidad?
Well, Brendan and I, we both research shipwrecks. We're really all about the history. And he has shipwrecks he's interested in. I have shipwrecks I'm interested in. And there's shipwrecks that we're both interested in. This one was primarily Brendan's, and he did the bulk of the research. But we could combine our resources research and physical resources like boats, sonars, and things like that. And we go out looking for these things.
You also were studying shipping lanes, and I'm wondering what that impact had on finding the location of the Trinidad.
The shipping lanes are very important. Generally, the vessels would try to follow lanes, mainly to give some organization to it, but to their sailing, but also to make it more efficient between different harbors. So we look at where the shipping lane was off Algoma, Wisconsin, and that gives us a clue as to where the Trinidad might have gone down.
So after abandoning the sinking ship with eight-person crew, the Trinidad captain, John Higgins, left accurate descriptions of where the vessel went down. But your colleague, Brendan Baylod, says few people, if any, had searched for the Trinidad. Why were you the only ones looking for this ship?
I had talked with some of the older divers and shipwreck hunters, and they knew about it. But at that time in the 60s and 70s, they just did not have the technology to dive at those depths. Since that time, there are divers now diving to those depths. And so that opened it up for us to go out there and look for it and get divers on it to study what happened and to learn from it. So we decided to go after it. It was findable with the information we had. And so we just went for it.
As you studied what happened and learned about the wreck, the records suggesting maintenance by the Trinidad's owners that was lacking and the ship was prone to leaking. How did you learn about the ship's poor upkeep?
It's in the historical records. We could see that they just were not maintaining it. And by reading the historical records, we could see that it was leaking all the time. And they just were not, the vessel was built above normal standards of the day. But once it went into service, the maintenance just was not being done at the level it needed to be. And oddly enough, most vessels of that type had two bilge pumps. This one, they had added a third bilge pump because it was leaking so much rather than fix whatever they needed to fix.
And this was the Trinidad's final voyage?
Yes. Yes, it was. It was going from Port Huron to Chicago with a cargo of coal.
We are talking about the discovery of the Trinidad shipwreck in Lake Michigan with shipwreck hunter Bob Jake. You can join in the conversation with your questions and your perspectives at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bob, you created a search area 10 miles out from Algoma that was 2 miles wide, 4 miles long. And once you were out on the water operating sonar equipment, how did you discover the shipwreck?
We had set aside 2 days to do this, and we went out there on July 15th. Unfortunately, a few days before that, there was a strong wind, and the wind was dying down, but it was still strong. So that first day on July 14th, it was really rough. and we were bouncing around, and we were right at the limit of what we thought we could handle and what the sonar could do. We completed almost half of the search and wrapped it up early that day, and we were feeling just terrible. And so we decided to get out early the next morning. It had really calmed down. So then we went out on July 15th, and we just had completed the first pass, and we came up on a target. Because of the speed, we were going a little faster than we normally would. But the morning was so good, we decided to pick up the speed on the boat to cover as much area as possible with the good weather. We talked about it for about 45 seconds, if we should go back and slow down and get better images of it. We weren't sure. So we did do that. We turned our boat around, went back over it, and we could tell right away we had a shipwreck.
Mm.
And we were pretty elated. But the next thing we did then was we stayed on site for about 2 hours, going back and forth at different angles over it to generate more images. So by the time we left there and went back to Algoma, we were about 95% sure we had found the Trinidad. And then we immediately on shore contacted the state underwater archaeologist.
Mm. How did you feel in that moment when you were almost certain that this was it?
We were elated. We were really happy. We just couldn't believe it. You know, this thing's been missing for so long, and this is going to add so much to Wisconsin's cultural history, underwater cultural history. It really was a major find for us. We were very happy.
When divers are exploring a new shipwreck site like this one, what precautions do you take as you like move around the wreckage and you make observations?
Well, what happened next after that was the state realized the importance of it. So then they brought out a professional ROV operator, and that's remote operated vehicle, Tom Crossman. So he came out August 3rd with his boat, and he put down a very expensive remote operated vehicle with archival quality sonar on it. Mm-hmm. So he was able to get sonar images of the entire vessel and photos. So the first thing we really all were looking for was fishing gear on there. Was there nets on there or fishing line, something that would endanger the lives of the fisher, of the divers, or even the ROV getting snagged on it. So safety was number one.
You have discovered several other shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. What is different about the Trinidad's condition?
It is, outside of the mast being down, it's almost fully intact. There's three cargo hatches. Of those three, two of them still have the covers on them, which is almost unheard of. The stern deck house is fully intact, and some of the windows still have the glass in them. I mean, this is just phenomenal. And we don't even know how it survives the sinking, going to the bottom and impacting the bottom and then staying all together like this. It was just, it was beyond our dreams.
Mm. I wonder why the ship could be so well preserved. Like how did that happen?
Water temperature was part of that. Being in the Great Lakes is another part of it. If it was in salt water, it would have been consumed within a few years by worms. So it was like in cold storage down there. Mm. And with this ship being built so well, even though it was leaking, it still was built above standards of the time. So it was able to survive that impact with the lake bottom and just waited to be found.
Mm. Wisconsin underwater archaeologist and maritime historian Bob Jake with us, our guide to his recent discovery of a well-preserved Lake Michigan shipwreck in Wisconsin waters. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the recent discovery of a long-lost schooner near the shoreline of Algoma on Lake Michigan. And we meet one of the shipwreck hunters who found the remarkably intact Trinidad after 2 years searching for it. You can join the conversation calling in with a question, sharing your perspective along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bob Jake is a board member of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. Bob, Wisconsin seeks to manage and protect most abandoned shipwrecks in Wisconsin waters. How did you help ensure the security of the Trinidad site?
We did that by contacting our state underwater archaeologists, and they are the protectors of our underwater resources by law. And so then she immediately contracted to get Tom Crossman out there with his remote operated vehicle on August 3rd. But then she did a follow-up with that on August 8th. Tammy and another diver named Zach Whitrock dove down on that wreck. And so what they do is they're not using typical scuba diving gear. They're using a closed circuit rebreathers because of the depth. This is around 270 feet deep. So they went down there, and Zach took thousands and thousands of photos, and Tammy took pictures. But Zach's cameras were taking a photo roughly every half a second. And what he does with that then is he has those photos using a computer program stitched together, and that creates a 3D model of this that we can see the entire vessel. And then Tammy went and took photos of specific things. And that's part of the process because they're photo preserving what's there. So as things degrade over the years, they can see what's happening. They can also see if somebody would steal something, which is illegal, that they could say, well, this item was part of this shipwreck at this time on this date. Hmm. So it's part of the protection of it.
But it is, as you mentioned, so far below the surface, you need specialized equipment to reach the wreck. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yes. Typical scuba diving is good for about 130 feet. And with this being 270, they're using, like I said, these closed circuit rebreathers.
Let's bring on a call now. Steve is with us in Sheboygan. Hi, Steve.
Hello, how are you? And hi, Bob, Steve.
Hi, Steve.
I think we know each other.
Yes.
I just want to congratulate, and I just want to mention that Bob is actually absolutely right. Years ago, back in the late 70s and 80s, there was a fellow from Two Rivers, Brendan, Barnard, by the name of Barnard. He looked for it, and we also looked for it a couple of times, sliding past when we came out of Sturgeon Bay. But again, where you found it was about 2 miles further out than where we were looking for it. And
Steve, how did you become a shipwreck hunter?
Exactly the same way that Bob did. Lucky years ago, I tagged along with one of the premier shipwreck hunters of the Great Lakes by the name of John Steele. He and I became good friends, and we started traveling all over the Western Great Lakes together looking for shipwrecks, and we were actually pretty successful. Mm. And it also then morphed into going after the history, and then we all became minor historians. I belong to some of the same organizations that Bob does. And
it sounds like there's a true community around this. Bob, how did you get so involved in this work?
I actually became interested in the history when I was at a bookstore in the late 70s on Great Lakes shipwrecks. And I read the book and I couldn't put it down. I went and bought a couple more books the next day. And I just started looking at the history of it. And then I decided to go to a local dive store and get certified in scuba diving. I wanted to see some of this stuff. So that's how it became a passion of mine. I don't really think of myself as a shipwreck hunter. I think of myself as a history hunter.
A history hunter, a maritime history hunter for the Great Lakes. And that kind of leads me to, how does someone do what you do? How do you start viewing and searching for shipwrecks? What are those initial steps to get started?
I would say meeting people like Steve, who was just on, or myself. And I go through a lot of old microfilms, looking at primary source materials as close as I can, reading up on the vessels. Also, Wisconsin has an incredible website called WisconsinShipwrecks.org. And that is a really good place to start. Also, it has the contact information for our state underwater archaeologist. Any questions or any help with anything, you can reach out to them. And also on that site, there's information about field work they've done and lighthouses.
Steve, thank you so much for calling in. As we talk with Bob Jake, who found the Trinidad shipwreck off of Algoma in Lake Michigan, you can join in with your questions about Great Lakes shipwrecks, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Patrick now in Madison. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. So, Bob, congratulations. And just a shout out, I play hockey with Brendan in Sun Prairie, and just love talking with him about shipwrecks. And I grew up on the Great Lakes, and my question is are there other shipwrecks that, hunters or historians are looking for right now? I know there's a lot of freighters that went down that haven't been found. Just curious about that.
Patrick, thanks so much for the call. Go ahead, Bob.
Wisconsin has roughly on record about, on the historical record, around 720 to 750 shipwrecks. And of that number, 225 roughly have been found and identified. So there's more to be found. And there are other ones on our list to look for.
How do you expect the discovery of this shipwreck will be studied by other researchers?
There's going to be more divers going on this, and they're going to look inside the cabins and things. They will study just how the ship held up all these years so well. Also, the rigging on this ship is part of the story. This was one of the early vessels with metal rigging. So when it sank, it kept the mast, even though the mast fell over, the masts are all still there, held in place by the rigging. And if it had rope rigging, it might not have held as well.
When the ship went down, the crew was able to get from the ship safely. Is that right? But I do understand the crew's dog, their mascot, wasn't able to make it.
Correct. The vessel was taking on water, and so they had all the pumps going. But then all of a sudden, the vessel lurched forward by the bow and went down. They had no time to get any belongings or to do anything. All eight men ran for the yawl boat and jumped in it. And as they were doing that, the vessel went down, and the captain's dog was down below sleeping by the stove. And they couldn't get him, and he couldn't get out in time. And so the dog went down with the vessel, which is very tragic. Mm.
Why are the Straits of Mackinac and this, the area around the Great Lakes, so difficult for schooners like this? Why is navigation dangerous?
Well, back in those days, there were a lot of forests. So there was forest fires. There was also fog, the regular weather that we run into here. Also, a lot of these occurred in October and November, especially November. They were making the last runs of the year, and the weather was getting bad. So you'd leave port, you would have overloaded ship. That was another thing. They would overload their ships quite often. And then these storms would come in, very strong November storms on overloaded vessels that were at the end of the season, probably needed all their maintenance. And they did not have the navigation equipment we have today. And so all this just conspired to create a lot of shipwrecks.
Hmm. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Kate.
Bob Jake is a board member of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association and an amateur Great Lakes shipwreck hunter, although I think he prefers that he's a maritime historian. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hospitals in Wisconsin receive high rankings in quality of care based on federal metrics. We dig into the findings on healthcare. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an iconic building in eastern Wisconsin.
On the western coast of Lake Michigan sits the city of Manitowoc, a place known for its deep connection with the water. And along its shore, a lighthouse, essential to the area's maritime history, stands tall, watching over the city. Molly Hunkin climbed inside to take us on a tour.
Okay, well, welcome to Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse. You're about half a mile out in the lake here. Ludington is about 60 miles across the lake straight over here, so you're out in the center of things here.
Paul Reckel is a member of Manitowoc Sunrise Rotary, a locally based group which organizes fundraising events for the community. Within the past decade, they have also become the official caretakers of the Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse. The lighthouse was built in 1918, making it over 100 years old. Its name comes from the structure that it's built on.
When you walked out here on the concrete, that's the breakwater. And basically what that is, it separates the lake from the harbor, and it makes a safe place for the ships to come in and be protected.
The building itself has five stories. Its first floor is a basement, which used to act as storage and a boathouse. In this portion of the basement was a dory, a small boat which lighthouse keepers used for rescues.
But you can read stories on it where the lighthouse keepers in its day would take care of the rescues out on the lake when they occurred. And even in the middle of winter, in a tremendous blizzard, at night, no lights. They had to listen to the sounds and actually push the boat out, hop in it, and go out and rescue the people and then bring it back in.
On the second floor, the motor room housed the motor to generate power for the light on top. Above that sits the watch room, where lighthouse keepers used radio equipment to keep in touch with boats out on the lake. In cases of stormy weather, sometimes lighthouse keepers stayed overnight in cots in this room, though they normally slept on shore. The diaphone room on the fourth floor used to be the location of the foghorn, also called a diaphone. Ships could activate the diaphone from the lake to warn of their arrival on shore. From the deck outside, you can see the Badger Car Ferry, which has been running since the 1950s, beginning its round trip between Manitowoc and Ludington, Michigan.
Two toots like that, that's a salute to us. Thank you.
After a brief climb up a small metal ladder, you reach what most people would think of when imagining a lighthouse, the lens house.
That's where the light that signals to the ships is located. And this particular light could be seen from 17 miles out in the lake, which is by no means...
The small room on top of the lighthouse holds no more than the light itself, with enough space for a few people around it. The expansive view looks out over Lake Michigan and the city of Manitowoc. After the need for lighthouse keepers disappeared, the building became run down. It succumbed to vandalism and the wear and tear expected for a building in the middle of a lake. But in 2011, the Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse was put on auction by the Coast Guard. It was purchased by a man from Long Island, New York, named Philip Carlucci, for $30,000.
You buy property from the Coast Guard, you have to bring it up to standards and maintain it. So he stuck over $325,000 into it to get it in the condition it is in today.
the owner and Manitowoc Sunrise Rotary are collaborating with the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, also located in Manitowoc, to return historical objects and equipment to the building. Looking forward, the owner hopes to continue restoring the lighthouse to its original state.
Molly Hunkin brought us that story on the Manitowoc Breakwater Lighthouse. The building itself is part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Wisconsin Hospital Association publishes its Wisconsin Healthcare Quality Report, analyzing federal metrics on hospital quality across areas like patient experience and mortality, readmissions. Call in with a question or comments about the ratings, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Kirkby is senior editor at Wisconsin Health News. Sean, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, so the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services use this five-star system to rate hospitals across the nation. And this year, the Wisconsin Hospital Association says about 3 in every 4 of our state's hospitals are rated at least 4 stars. How does this rating system measure quality of healthcare?
Yeah. So basically, these star ratings are a summary of a series of measures that takes a few years back look to see how hospitals are performing. So hospitals receive higher markers for having lower death rates for certain conditions like stroke and heart failure. They're rated on patient safety metrics like rates of hospital-associated infections. Medicare also looks at readmission rates, so how frequently patients are returning to the hospitals after discharge, following a procedure. They also take a look at patients' experience, so their evaluations and whether providers communicate well or whether or not they understood follow-up care when they left the hospital. And finally, also take a look at timely and effective care, like the percentage of patients who left the emergency department before being seen. So these are kind of some of the things that they're looking at. And as you know, at Wisconsin, hospitals fared well in the rankings. 38% of the hospitals in the state that were rated by Medicare received 5 stars, which was the 4th highest percentage in the nation. And that was actually, I believe the number is higher than the number of actual hospitals receiving the 5 stars is higher than in other states that were above us. So they did pretty well.
You talked about these measures like mortality and safety, readmission. What category do you find most interesting?
I think I've written a lot about kind of readmissions in general. And this idea that there are these kind of large federal programs now that are looking at helping hospitals make sure that patients are receiving quality care before they leave the hospital so they don't have to return unless something goes wrong. And so there's been a lot of efforts at the federal level, at the state level, to try and help prevent people from coming back to facilities for care that they don't necessarily need.
The Wisconsin Hospital Association saying 29 hospitals in our state have this 5-star rating. When you look at that, and I wonder, you know, which hospitals are highly rated? Where do you find patterns?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure where all the 29 hospitals are. In general, I would say that these ratings are kind of in line with other reports that have come out that have shown Wisconsin hospitals to have a higher quality than their peers across the nation. There's been a large focus on quality efforts in the state, including through, you know, trade associations and kind of emphasis on, you know, adopting technology and other sort of steps to make sure that hospitals are providing that quality care.
You know, stepping back from the five stars, there's also one-star reviews, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, I mean, these hundreds of hospitals got a one-star rating. How should we regard them, especially if one is in our community?
I think that in general, this is one look at hospital ratings. So you should definitely look at other reviews of hospitals, other kind of ranking systems. When considering care, you should be consulting with doctors and your providers when you're trying to pursue a procedure. And you should take a look at other sort of surveys on patient experience, because this is just, you know, kind of one look. Mm-hmm. I would say that, you know, a one star is a red flag, and you should probably really take a closer look at what procedures you're looking to pursue at that facility, and whether or not you do want to receive your care there.
So these latest ratings show improvement over last year. Does that mean quality of care at hospitals is improving?
Yeah, there is just a very strong focus on trying to improve quality at hospitals throughout the state. And there's a lot of efforts that are going on to do that in terms of, you know, further research into some of the data that's available through electronic health records now. I think it also kind of reflects a renewed focus on quality after the COVID-19 pandemic, which mm-hmm. took up a lot of resources from hospitals. A lot of patients were being seen and cared for. So it's kind of a sign of, you know, hospitals kind of pivoting back to focusing on some of the things that they've been focusing on for a long time, but now have renewed resources to do so.
Amid the mergers that are taking place in Wisconsin, this month we see Friedert Health and ThetaCare taking another step toward merging. Last year it was Gunderson Health System and Bellin Health merged, as did Advocate Aurora Health and Atrium Health. Are hospital mergers affecting ratings?
Yeah, I think the jury's kind of still out on this and how hospitals will affect, how these mergers and consolidations will affect hospital quality going forward. A lot of these mergers are kind of in their stages of infancy. So there is like a period of time when the hospitals have to kind of figure out how to come together after they, you know, officially join forces. So I'm not sure if we're seeing that reflected in the data yet. But, you know, hospital leaders who have pursued mergers have cited technology and investing in quality as major reasons for why they're pursuing these mergers, to kind of get the scale to, you know, afford to co-invest in some of these new technologies that could help improve care. And so you mentioned Friedert and ThetaCare. They're saying quality is a major reason for coming together, both to, you know, grow their patient bases, to invest in technology, to be able to attract further talent. But there's also studies out there that have shown that mergers don't necessarily improve quality, in part because there's a decline in competition between different health systems. You're no longer facing that competitive pressure to provide quality care. You know, last month, KFF, which is a health policy think tank known as the Kaiser Family Foundation, reads a study looking at cross-market mergers, which is a lot of what's happening in Wisconsin. And those are mergers where health systems aren't sharing like the same service area. And they found that, you know, in some cases, large health systems can bring more resources to smaller hospitals to help, potentially in rural areas. In other cases, they may move to cut resources or service lines.
To consolidate.
So I think, so we'll have to kind of see as these mergers move forward, where kind of what happens to these quality rankings.
Sean Kirkby with the news outlet Wisconsin Health News, examining the quality of hospitals around the state, latest federal measures. Call in with a question, add your insights, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the quality of healthcare in Wisconsin and what could influence the patient experience in the future with the senior editor of Wisconsin Health News. Call in with a question. Share your insights. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Kirkby stays with us, senior editor for Wisconsin Health News. Sean, turning to workforce, Wisconsin's healthcare workforce needs to grow at a faster rate to keep up with our state's aging population, and that's according to a recent workforce report from the Wisconsin Hospital Association. How are hospitals seeking to address the workforce challenges?
That's a good question, Kate. I think they're using a lot of different approaches to try to grow their workforce, and that includes starting kind of new medical education programs. For instance, ThetaCare, which is in the Fox Valley, a health system there, they recently launched a graduate medical education program with the hopes that if you're able to train doctors here, there's good evidence suggesting that they will remain in the communities that they serve. So that's kind of a longer term solution, is to try to grow residency programs here to keep doctors in state after they leave. There's kind of pushes to allow providers to practice at the top of their license to kind of fill in these gaps. There's pushes at the state level as well to allow for, more providers to have sort of independence and hopefully fill some of these other gaps that we're seeing.
When you say practice at the top of their license, what do you mean by that?
So it would just be kind of knocking down some barriers to care in a lot of instances. So for an example, might be to implement a new technology that might reduce what a doctor has to do that isn't patient care. So for instance, in Madison right now, UW Health is taking a look at potentially using artificial intelligence to help draft messages responding to electronic messages. And then doctors can kind of come in, read these messages, decide whether or not they're adequate to respond to this. But that can kind of free up doctors' time to kind of focus more on patient care and what they had to do at the bedside.
As we discuss artificial intelligence, Wisconsin Health News held a panel conversation about artificial intelligence in healthcare, and Frank Liao of UW Health said health systems across the country want oversight. Here's the Senior Director of Digital Health and Emerging Technologies.
When I talk with a lot of health systems across the country, many of them have actually oversight groups that have DEI representation as well as bioethics representation, and we have that as well. And so every time we look at an AI tool, we always ask ourselves some of these questions around disparities, health equity, ethics, as well as privacy and security.
Okay, so a lot going on there. Sean, Liao says the future of AI has hospital systems questioning privacy and security. How is hospital collaboration protecting patients?
Yeah, I think that there are kind of some of these pushes for more oversight of AI, and hospitals kind of want to be involved in, particularly as state legislators and state regulators and federal regulators take a look at these issues to make sure that patients are protected and that their information is secure. I think another thing that is kind of important too, that Frank was talking about our panel, are efforts to make sure that when we use artificial intelligence and technologies like that, there aren't unintended consequences. For example, one concern is that AI may perpetuate health disparities. There's some evidence suggesting that if you have a bias within your data set, the artificial intelligence that's reading it and doing machine learning on it might replicate that and go and perpetuate that bias. So that's part of the oversight that they're looking at in terms of making sure that that information and that that technology is being helpful and not hurting folks. Mm. When it comes to, you know, security concerns, I think that is a major worry, though, as we adopt a lot of these new technologies and other stuff, particularly, you know, just a few weeks ago, there's a health system in that serves parts of Wisconsin that was hit by a cybersecurity attack that took out their electronic health record for a while. Mm. And that does kind of pose, it interrupts care. They were still able to serve patients, but it does kind of pose some issues when it comes to, you know, serving the community.
Let's bring on a call. Andrew in Milwaukee. Andrew, you're with Sean Kirkby, the senior editor at Wisconsin Health News.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling in regards to the residency program. So my girlfriend is in med school now, and she's applying to residencies. And she's been talking about how there's fewer residency positions. Or sorry, fewer positions than there are applicants.
Fewer positions than applicants.
By the federal government.
Yes, and Andrew, I have to cut you short here. Sean, is there a shortage, a doctor shortage? And what about the number of, you know, positions for residents?
Yeah, there is, and there are, I mean, that's a good question. There are kind of sort of caps on some of these programs. So there is pushes to kind of boost and establish more residency slots. There was some funding in our state's budget to do that. And that has been a focus on a lot of health systems and doctors groups. But yeah, there's a significant gap there, and it kind of needs to be addressed to kind of meet the needs of the country and the state.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for sharing your reporting.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate.
Sean Kirkby is a senior editor of Wisconsin Health News. And if you have an idea for what the morning show should cover next, healthcare, maybe another industry, please get in touch with us at any time. Email ideas@WPR.org. We welcome ideas for future programs. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.